This is a Defocus Media production. Welcome to episode 1 of the ODs on Facebook podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Fayez Mahgoub, and today we're tackling the topic of disruption in eye care. Joining me today are Dr. Jeffrey Sansino and Mr. Andy Barrow. Dr. Sansino is an optometrist practicing in Nashville, Tennessee. He is a diplomate of the cornea and contact lens section of the American Academy of Optometry, an executive board member of the Healthcare Alliance for Patient Safety, past chairman of the American Optometric Association's contact lens and cornea section, as well as fellow of the Scleral Lens Education Society. In 2017, Dr. Sansino was recognized by the Gas Permeable Lens Institute as Practitioner of the Year, as well as being recognized as the 2017 AOA Advocate of the Year. In 2018, Dr. Sansino was recognized as Optometrist of the Year by the Tennessee Optometric Association. Mr. Barrow is a serial entrepreneur with a wide range of startup experience. He has raised almost $20 million in funding and has taken 3 startups from concept to profitability over the past 6 years. He also brings to the discussion over 20 years in senior executive management experience, which has included establishing a division to monetize intellectual property for an applied futurism firm on Madison Avenue in New York City. During that time, Mr. Barrow consulted for the likes of Coca-Cola, Bayer, Allergan, Citibank, Campbell's, and the National Football League. Dr. Sansino and Mr. Barrow would like to disclose a financial interest in a company that we'll be discussing later in this podcast called Iris. Gentlemen, I'd like to get your thoughts on the word disruption. It seems to me like a loaded word. Some folks have a positive connotation of it. Some have a negative connotation of it. What are your thoughts on the word and how do you view disruption in eye care?
Disruption, you know, can be a good and bad thing, which is why people relate to it differently. I think, you know, I've seen plenty of examples of disruption that has been good for consumers and businesses alike and others, especially when we're talking about eye care, where the disruption has not been so positive. And one of the things that, you know, I've seen in my past is that ultimately, you know, disruptors that are coming into a market and, you know, doing something that benefits everybody are the ones that are ultimately very successful. But where in the eye care case, you know, disruption is only good, appears to only be good for the people that are actually disrupting a single segment and benefiting only one part of the relationship, which is causing inequities in other places. So for the likes of Waldo, et cetera, and Hubble, where they are doing good by the consumer relative to price and convenience, obviously it's not a good product. The doctors are eliminated out of the mix. So it's not a good example of disruption.
And so is care. And I think that's the biggest point, is that they are diverting care from occurring.
That's an important point that you brought up, Jeff. Can you elaborate on the implications for quality of care, considering these new companies providing eye care services, but whose leadership doesn't even have a science background, let alone prior experience in eye care?
Well, first, Fayez, one of the things you mentioned there was that people coming from outside the industry are the ones who are disrupting right now. And I just want to give you an example of the most recent article that I saw about Hubble. You know, somebody from their organization made a comment that methylphilcon A, there's no studies that show that that is an inferior material, when in fact, there are tons of studies, very well-constructed, randomized, multi-center clinical studies that show that methylphilcon A, meaning a material that has an inferior decay over T, is in fact not a good material to put on patients. And so here we have a marketing guy, basically, who doesn't understand care at all, making incorrect statements in national media because he just doesn't understand or has an ability to read the literature.
I mean, one of the good examples that I use relative to disruption, you know, is, you know, Harry's was a great example of somebody that came along and did a wonderful job at disrupting Gillette, right? And stealing a huge amount of market share. And I think a lot of these people that have come into the eye care space, you know, are looking at the mechanics behind direct-to-consumer approach, marketing, social media, and everything else. But here's the difference. And this is the big difference, is that a shaving kit or whatever that may be. I do not need a prescription to shave, you know. So they're applying all of the mechanics relative to a great business model, but they're completely disconnected from the fact that this is in an area that's managed completely differently, and they have no experience in and around that.
Yeah, Andy, shaving kits or whatever the devices are for shaving are not class 2 and class 3 medical devices
exactly.
that have the ability to cause blindness.
You know, they're coming from outside the medical space, and that's exactly what they are doing. They're just white labeling existing product, you know, putting it in a sexy box, marketing it very well to consumers. And in fairness, that's why consumers may have adopted it and may have started using it, but it's also the same reason that product and online vision tests have resulted in thousands of complaints of the FTC.
And the reason for that is that these are medical devices that need to be monitored. And so, you know, you talk about disruption, you're talking about contact lens companies primarily, but then you have contact lens companies who are partnering with telemedicine. And, you know, the perfect example there is 1-800-CONTACTS, who is diverting patients from care by trying to sell their contact lens basically direct to consumer by incorporating an online vision test. Optometrist, which became Visibly, was not legalized. So it was not a test that was run through the FDA. The FDA issued them a cease and desist order, and subsequently Visibly has closed up shop. Now, that hasn't happened with 1-800's site test yet, online site test. So, you know, the AOA is working to, you know, to educate the FTC and the FDA about 1-800's answer to that.
So to put this into context, this is not the first time that eye care had to deal with these types of outside forces. Can you tell us about times in your career where you've seen eye care have to address these types of challenges?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when big box retailers and chain locations came into eye care, people in private practice ran around saying, oh my God, the sky is falling. And what ended up happening is, yes, there is a certain segment of the population that will get their eye care done at retail locations and at big box locations. But eye care has weathered that, and private practice, ODMD practices, academia are all very strong despite some of the kind of commoditization of eye care. You know, that's one thing. Another thing that has come along in our industry are private equity groups. So, you know, private equity groups coming in and buying private practices, this is not a new phenomenon. I mean, this has happened in waves previously in my career. And it was actually very interesting what happened in the past. Private equity groups would come in, they'd buy up a bunch of practices. The quality of care would go down in those practices. And then the optometrists who sold them the practices ended up buying them back. Now, it's not to say that that's going to happen in this wave of private equity buying the practices, but, you know, this has happened before, and optometry has always survived. And there's a reason for this, Thais. The reason why optometry has always survived is that the private practitioner, the ODMD practice, the academic optometrists have always had the patient's best interests in mind at all times. And as long as we continue to do that, optometrists and optometry as an industry will always survive. You take care of the patient first and foremost, and then you let the business model work itself out after that.
I mean, to add to that, relative to private equity, I think that, you know, in years that have gone past, in those earlier waves where they were making those decisions that resulted in them losing the practices or being repurchased, I think today we're seeing a lot smarter private equity companies that are coming in and saying, look, we want to buy you because we're a profit center and you do your job well, and we're actually going to allow you to maintain the practice just as you would, as if, you know, we're just a silent partner. So, and again, I think you're seeing a case of, you know, they've evolved in their approach and realized, look, you know, it's one thing to buy them. It's another thing for us to try and run them. You know, the reason that they're attractive for us to buy is because this doctor or group of doctors have done such a great job building a business. So that's why they're leaving it alone now. So more and more we're seeing better results coming out of private equity arrangements.
There are two types of private equities in our marketplace right now. There are some that come in and buy the practice and basically turn the practice into a chain location. And then there are others that come in and leave the purchasing decisions and leave the control of the practice in the hands of the selling optometrist.
The main theme that I see there is that it seems to be something that's driven by market forces. I see a lot of venture capital backing a lot of these different efforts. What role do you see venture capital playing in the future of optometry, either good or bad?
I'll shoot first. You know, I think a lot of the big money that's coming in, we're talking about private equity, and they see an industry where, frankly, you know, you don't have to be a business genius in order to thrive and flourish as an optometrist. You know, you see your patients day in and day out. There are wonderful ways of supporting a practice with our current model, and private equity groups want a piece of that money.
Well, I think we've clearly seen the negative notes. I mean, with companies like Hubble that have raised $75 million from venture capital, you know, that's an example of where, you know, the venture capital companies are looking at models that have worked in other areas. So they see that and they realize that eye care, you know, has been an industry that's been somewhat untouched for decades, you know, outside of, you know, the hiccups like 1-800-CONTACTS and things like that coming on the scene. They didn't see a lot up until recently, but they're going to learn very quickly that they need to get involved with businesses that are still keeping the doctor a part of the actual equation. Because again, all of the ones that, I mean, Waldo's another one, $40 million, they're all chasing, you know, the direct-to-consumer approach, because it's a model that they've seen work in thousands of other spaces, but it's not working in eye care for the reasons that, you know, we keep talking about. And that is that the doctor's been cut out of the mix. So that's their examples of it, the bad examples of venture capital money, because they're not doing enough due diligence to ask that question about, hey, there doesn't appear to be a lot of oversight here. Where's the connection to the industry?
So we definitely see that market forces are a big driver of some of these different disruptive endeavors and enterprises that are in eye care and that will be coming in the future. I do also see that technology also plays a role in these. So for example, a lot of the companies offering online refractions depended on there being cell phones available to where a patient can use that as a means of getting an auto refraction, essentially. What type of technologies do you feel like are on the horizon, and how do you feel like they're going to be impacting our field? I hear a lot about artificial intelligence and telemedicine. What role do you think those will be playing, and where the doctor will fit in as those technologies get rolled out?
You know, I think, will there be technologies that come along that provide the technical aspect of a refraction? Potentially. I mean, yes, that's an inevitability. But I'm always reminded of, there was a wonderful book that I used to teach the ophthalmology residents from when I was at an academic medical center, and it was called The Fine Art of Refracting Without Making a Spectacle of Yourself. And I can't recall the author of the book, but in the book, he, you know, and this is time-tested, right? This book was from the 80s or 90s. And in the book, there is a poem that he writes, and he says, "By now you know it is a fact, there are machines that can refract. One thing will always be true, complaints will come back to you." And the point of that poem is that while the technical piece is something that, yes, it is a critical part of what we do, when we do a refraction, it has very little to do with that technical piece. And it has everything to do with the fact that the brain needs to tolerate the prescription that we generate. And so I feel like no matter what technology comes along to be able to do that, it will always take the doctor's intuition on figuring out what works best for that individual patient. AI does a great job at, you know, searching for a melanoma in an ocular photograph, or a melanoma on the skin in dermatology. But what AI does not do is individualize treatment plans for individual patients. And so I think no matter what technology comes along, there will always be a need for a doctor to interpret the results. And I'm not talking about a doctor sitting in an office in Bangladesh dealing with a patient in Tennessee. I'm talking about a face-to-face interaction with a doctor to personalize the medical plan for that patient.
I definitely agree with you there, Jeff. I feel like there will always be patients who appreciate the one-on-one care that they get from a doctor, and also patients who have already established relationships with their optometrist and don't necessarily see a need for going outside of that loop. I do wonder, though, for folks who are not currently in the eye care system, or for folks who don't necessarily have that tight bond with an eye care provider, how easy it will be for them to be swayed into some of these upcoming modalities of providing care. For example, last year, the FDA approved an algorithm that can screen for diabetic retinopathy from a fundus photo. And we're seeing some of those systems go into place in primary care physicians' offices, where once the patient goes in for their annual or semi-annual diabetes follow-up, they get a photo taken, and that's also screening for diabetic retinopathy. Now, that can be nice for folks that were never going to go see an eye doctor and would have not been in the eye care system and wouldn't have an opportunity to get care. But it also raises the question, what if a patient comes to you after going to their GP and they've already had an OCT and a fundus photo taken, analyzed by AI, brings the report with them, but guess what? The insurance for that patient was already billed for those things. And so the OCT that you purchased, the fundus photograph instrumentation that you have in your office, is not going to be able to generate revenue for that patient encounter because that's already been billed. Do you feel like some of those things, even if they're not completely taking the doctors and the patients and separating them, even within the current system that we have, that they could alter the financials of what it takes to operate a sustainable practice?
There's a couple aspects to that question, Fayez. Number one is access, right? I will tell you that the American Optometric Association has statistics that 95% of Americans have an optometrist available to them within a 10-mile drive. And so the question of access in America is not a valid one. The telemedicine companies all love to say, well, we're providing more access, we're providing more access. But when it comes to eye care, do you completely upend a system that has 95% coverage of the United States? And I think the answer to that is no. And I'll give you an example of, I have an optometrist friend who just came to me with this scenario. They had a patient that sat down in the chair that came in for a red eye evaluation. And the patient admitted that prior to sitting down in the optometrist chair, the insurance company, his insurance carrier, had persuaded him to do an online evaluation with one of their doctors. That incidentally, it's kind of funny, the patient had to pay outside of the insurance coverage. So the insurance carrier had them pay outside the insurance coverage for one of their doctors to evaluate them. The patient ended up with a sty, and the online provider provided the wrong treatment for that patient. So by the time the patient ended up in the optometrist chair, so a delaying of care, they had an infection of the eyelid. So a true infection that needed oral antibiotics. And so if the patient had just sought the optometrist in the first place, the correct care would have been given at a much lower cost, right? Hot compresses and digital massage are free. But when this system is mucked up by insurance carriers trying to subvert care or divert care, it's just not ready. The system is just not ready for that yet.
I do see that eventually more and more aspects of the eye exam will involve technology, things like AI. But in the meantime, between now and when those technologies can offer a comprehensive eye exam, I feel that from an advocacy perspective for patient care, we need to make sure that any new technology that comes online is scrutinized effectively. And if it doesn't provide adequate patient care, that we actually fight against it and we ensure that the quality of eye care is not actually compromised. Jeff, can you talk a little bit about some of your work with the AOA and what you feel like some of these organizations who represent optometry and advocate for patients can actually bring to the table in this situation?
Sure. You know, Fayez, we've talked about the idea that really the only barrier to every Tom, Dick, and Harry venture capitalist getting involved with, you know, diverting a patient from proper care is the optometrist fighting for our patients. the only way that optometrists are able to fight for our patients is when we get together. And the only way we get together is through the American Optometric Association. Now, listen, everyone that I talk to has their own opinion of the American Optometric Association. Some people are diehards. Some people are just very against some of the decisions that have been made in the past with the AOA. And what I would tell everybody listening to this is that whatever your beef was with the AOA in the past, whether it was board certification or some other, you know, decision that you didn't agree with, it is time to lay that down. Because in this time of unprecedented disruption, the only thing that stands between corporate interests who do not have your patients in mind, their well-being in mind, and those things just ravaging the industry is the AOA. The AOA is the only one fighting against this. And I can tell you that it is a prime directive of the AOA to always keep the doctor-patient relationship intact. There are tons of people at the AOA fighting every single day. AOA staff, AOA volunteers, the board of the AOA that truly have optometry's interests in mind. And if you're not a member of the AOA, for whatever reason it was in the past, it is the time in your career to come back and rejoin the AOA. And I cannot stress that enough. Because when we go to Washington, and if we have to say to legislators, hey, yeah, you know what, we represent less than 50% of optometrists out there, guess what? They don't listen to us. We need to have a strong, concerted effort when we're talking to legislators, which is really, you know, this is a legislative profession. We're dropping bills in Washington to try and stem the tide of illegal companies coming in and trying to skim money from our patients. And this is a battle. This is a war. The AOA is the only national organization that is waging that war. Now, look, we can win on this front in many ways. A national organization like the AOA is one of the ways that we have to win. You know, there are other like campaigns like Think About Your Eyes that are very important. But one of the other ways that we are going to win this war is from a business perspective. So it is very important that we aggregate into national organizations. But we also have to fight these disruptors from a business perspective.
That's a great point, Jeff, because we can't only be bringing the aspect of we provide great patient care, because we've done that for decades. We're going to continue to do that for decades, but we have to do it in a way that is competitive and that addresses what's happening in the market. And so if there is a need or an opportunity that's exposed by a disruptor that doesn't care about patient care, as we're fighting them, we have to understand what they did to actually attract patients or to provide a value proposition for patients. And then we have to take the good parts of that and actually implement them to better serve our own patients. And to that end, I actually wanted to have you and Andy talk to us a little bit more about the project that you've been working on, Iris, and what that does that actually hasn't been done from an eye care perspective before, and how it blends the best of both worlds from what's been seen before from disruptors, but also coming in with ensuring that there's patient care and that it's something that's going to be actually helping the provider.
So one of the things that we are offering as a company is a contact lens that is a top technology daily disposable. The material that we have is the lowest modulus, which means stiffness rating of any material on the market. So it's a very comfortable material. But we've been able to manufacture this in a base curve that is different than the standard base curve that would be substitutable online. So we've created a proprietary lens. This is not a private label like that's been done in the past where it's purely substitutable because it's equivalent. This is a novel lens that is available through our network of optometrists and also available directly from our company, Iris, online. Now, when the patient purchases from us, because there are some patients that want to buy lenses at 10 o'clock at night from their living room. But when the patient purchases from us, the doctor who prescribed that lens receives the same margin as if they had sold the product in their office. And so it completely keeps the doctor in the equation no matter where the lens is purchased.
That's a really interesting model, and it seems that you guys are trying to blend the best of both worlds from the convenience standpoint for patients and the ability to reach patients through social media marketing and a campaign like Cobble, but taking the negative aspects by actually tying all dispensed lenses to an in-person exam with a doctor. Is that correct?
Yes, and further to that point, you know, our company stands for the doctor-patient relationship. And so all of this ridiculous advertising that Hubble and 1-800 are doing on social media to try to divert from quality care, we are counter-messaging with the same level of intensity and the same level of edginess and attractability from the consumer. But we are advertising the opposite message that, hey, you know what? We can give you the same kind of conveniences through optometrist offices, but provide you a much higher quality of care than you would get if you had done this with an online vision test. And so the other product that we have launched to counter some of the bad behavior is a patient finder. Andy, do you want to talk about the patient finder?
So what happens is the consumer sees one of our ads, they click on the link, yeah, to set up an appointment, they fill out very basic information, how far they're willing to travel, when do they want to see a doctor today, tomorrow, what time frame. Then our system actually pings all of the doctors in the region in which they're willing to travel by way of an email, desktop notifications, and texts. The doctors have set up who is to receive all of these notifications in the practice. The first three doctors to respond, they get culled into an email back to that consumer within 15 to 30 minutes of when they made the application. It says, look, we've got three doctors that are willing to see you on your schedule, and three top eye doctors too. They're very clear about that. And then they just get to click on that one. They look at the reviews. They look at the little mini bios in that email. They select one, and then they get a notification to say, good, you're all set, show up at the doctor's office. The doctor's office has now got all of your information.
We're hitting the convenience button that a lot of the disruptors have been hammering really hard. And we're offering patients a same-day or next-day appointment with a top optometrist on their schedule.
Yeah.
And so far, that has really resonated with consumers.
That's really interesting. So it seems like Iris is three things rolled into one, starting with an educational campaign to go out there and meet patients where they are and educate them about the importance of their overall eye health in addition to getting more contact lenses, and then facilitating a way for them to link them with a doctor that's going to offer them their routine eye exam and that contact lens prescription. And then the third leg of that is the actual contact lens product itself. For some of our listeners that do want to learn more about Iris, where can they go to learn more?
MyIris.com for consumers, and still the same thing for doctors as well. They just have the doctor sign up button in the top right of the page where it takes them to a portal where they can learn a lot more in detail about the business side.
I'm sure also that we're going to have listeners who are wanting to follow up with you guys about maybe some questions that we didn't get to cover on the podcast today, or maybe just wanting to get your thoughts on some additional topics. What is the best way for a listener to get a hold of you, Jeff, and also you, Andy?
I think the best way is by email. Just email me at jeff@myiris.com and Andy's is andy@myiris.com. You know, we're engaging with practitioners every single day. Our network is blowing up. We have doctors all across the country, in Alaska, in Puerto Rico. Doctors we're finding are very, very interested in this idea. And that's really our big push right now, is to grow that network to the top practices across the U.S.
That's fantastic. I'm sure that after the podcast here, that there'll be even more interest of folks who want to reach out and kind of learn more about Iris as an ecosystem and whether it's a good fit for their practice. And I'm sure we'll be touching base with you guys again and seeing how things are going a little bit further down the road. I personally wish you both the best of luck. I feel like it's a great collaboration between the business world and the eye care world, and that we need to be experimenting with these different models if we're going to be constantly staying at the cutting edge of what serves patients, both as patients who we care about, but also as consumers, because at a certain degree, patients want certain things that are beyond what we offer in the exam room as far as convenience, as far as pricing, and having someone who cares about the patient care, but also is looking to address these other things to keep us competitive as optometrists in those other fields is something that I think is really important. And I did want to thank you both for joining me today here on the podcast, and we'll be looking forward to keeping up with you and staying in touch.
Thanks, Fayez.
That's a wrap for this episode, but it's only the beginning of the conversation. Please share your thoughts with us in the comment section on odsonfacebook.com, as well as in the ODs on Facebook group. If you have questions for our guests that you feel the whole community would benefit from learning the answers to, then please share those in the comments as well. Our guests will be jumping in the comments to continue the discussion with the community. And if you enjoyed the podcast, make sure you subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher by searching for ODs on Facebook podcast. Thanks, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next episode.